Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I keep saying daily, but I want to commit myself to doing it daily, although we do
it's week daily.
Well, it's pretty much daily. It's pretty
daily.
Close. And I try to uphold it. I feel embarrassed if I don't actually do it every single day. I'm Charlie Sykes. Again, you can subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, any platform, and we are joined once again. You've already heard him, David Preece, the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare. How are you?
I am well. How are you, Charlie?
Good. We just had a fascinating conversation about the uses and abuses of Wi-Fi on airplanes. This is something we have to work through.
It's probably a subject for a whole other podcast. I'm not sure the listeners will want to hear that one, but we could do it. That could be the Sunday version.
They could listen, because it's interesting. When I fly, one of the things I always do is I listen to podcasts because they automatically download. Mm-hmm. So even if I don't buy the Wi-Fi, I can listen to a podcast. Very, very convenient.
And if you do a long flight, you can get through a whole lot of back episodes.
Well, you were mentioning, the it's the flight from East Coast to West Coast. You have a block of 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And pre-Wi-Fi.
We read books.
We actually read books.
Some people actually, I know this is crazy, yeah. Charlie. Some people actually spoke to other passengers. Isn't that crazy?
Well, it can be.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's something. It can also lead
to violence.
No, it is interesting, though. You can sit next to somebody for 4 hours without speaking to them once. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, you can go on Wi-Fi and you can get a lot of work done. But you were pointing out that you can do both. You can put it down and still read that book thing.
Right. It takes a lot of willpower. And not all of us have the willpower to put down that Wi-Fi. But when you have a good book, sometimes that is the stronger pull.
Yeah. The only problem I always have is that I'm always thinking, do I want to carry on a heavy book to do that?
Depends on what book you're bringing. You know, if you're bringing the one I was thinking of recently was Reclaiming History, which was the compendium about the Kennedy assassination and all of the conspiracy theories that Vince Bugliosi debunked. And that thing you can't carry on a plane.
Yeah.
I think it exceeds weight restrictions by itself. But if it's a slim volume, you take it, you knock that out.
Yeah, I actually was sitting the other morning and I had in my hand the book I really wanted to read. It's the Catherine the Great biography by Robert Massey. But it's a big book. I'm sorry.
Well, for that, you need the flight to New Zealand.
Yeah, there's other things that are going on here. So we have a lot of things to talk about. And I specifically wanted to talk with you about Jared Kushner and the issue of clearance, you being an expert.
Sure.
For people who haven't listened before, which I, shame on you if you haven't listened before, but you've written several books on this. You used to give the briefing, so this is something that's near and dear to your heart. So give me the background.
Sure.
The Jared Kushner story on one level, like so many other stories in the Trump era, is shocking but not surprising. You know, shocking that the president ordered it, but you kind of knew that the fix was in for the son-in-law.
Sure. The background for this combines a few things. It's the Venn diagram overlapping presidential power and security clearances. It's about Twitter, and it's about humanity. I know I'm really selling it.
Oh, this is good.
I know I'm really selling
it. I'm just going to sit back and listen to this now.
But here's what happened is, I think it was on Thursday, both the New York Times and the Washington Post reported separately that the president had overruled security officials on Jared Kushner's clearance. And there, of course, ensued the great news scramble to get after elements of this, to comment on it. Everything was dominated by it for probably the next 24 hours. During that 24 hours, a few people were tweeting about it, including me and including National Security Attorney Mark Zaid. And we disagreed on one minor issue, which was the use of the word abuse of power as opposed to misuse or inappropriate use of power. And we started to respond to each other in a way that Twitter often brings out in us, which is getting increasingly testier.
I've noticed this.
Yes. And at one
this
point,
is a thing.
At one point, we pressed pause, just said, can you call me? Let's talk through this.
Yeah.
And we ended up having a real conversation. And in that conversation, we realized we agreed about 99% of things. Let's write an op-ed about that. So the Washington Post on Saturday published our co-authored piece on Jared Kushner's security clearances, presidential power, and what is and isn't reality. So for us, that was a lesson about don't get into a death spiral on Twitter that brings out the worst in us. Actually talk to people.
So you guys were hating each other on Twitter and end up writing a piece together.
Yeah, we weren't yet to hate. We were in the pre-hate stage.
It's kind of like
Twitter.
A Hallmark movie.
Yeah, it's like that without as much romance. and yeah. as much but physical contact.
But so it's sure. but it is amazing though that, that human beings interacting with one another are more productive
it can,
than
it can still happen in 2019.
Okay, so just to back up on all of this. So,
that's not the substance. Yeah, the substance was.
But so the president orders that Jared Kushner be given the security clearance, overriding security officials. Which security officials?
That we don't know where the separate adjudications came from, but it appears it came from the investigation into him and his many repeated attempts to clarify contacts on his security forms. The reporting said that the chief of staff, and I think at least one of the reports said Don McGahn as well, had said, basically, no, Mr. President, we really shouldn't do this. And he said, do it anyway. What struck Mark and I was that the reaction to this was, well, the president can't do that. Well, actually, the president can. It derives directly from his Article II powers as commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. The president has control over granting and revoking security clearances. He can do it. That doesn't mean he should do it. And that's what we tried to tease out in the article, is yes, he has the power to do it. So don't be out there like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who I understand is proposing legislation to revoke his clearance.
Which would be unconstitutional.
Ain't going to happen. The Constitution trumps law. So in that case, put your attention elsewhere. If you think that this is an inappropriate use of a clear presidential power, if you think this is a misuse, an abuse of a presidential power, don't argue that he can't do it. Take action. Take oversight. Start getting documents. Start bringing people in for testimony. Ultimately, you can use the power of the purse, Congress. At the extreme, if you determine that this was a blatant abuse, if it proves the president is unfit for office, then you can do something like impeachment. And of course, it all comes back to the people eventually. That can inform the public about a 2020 decision of, do we want this person in that chair in the Oval
Office? This is an important distinction because, I mean, often you have the right to do something, but it's not the right thing to do. And also a reminder of how much of our system of government is based on kind of the honor system, the assumption that we're going to give the president these kinds of sweeping powers, that he will exercise it in an honorable, reasonable, responsible way.
Not only that he will do so, but frankly, that we, the people, will put someone in that position who is capable of doing so. So perhaps shame on him, whoever the him has been, when presidents have not lived up to our standards. Frankly, shame on us for not vetting them in the election season the way that we wanted and putting someone in office who did not live up to those standards.
Now remind me how this works, though, because and I'm not an expert in this, but that my understanding was there was basically two steps, though, that there is the regular security clearance, and then there's a security clearance that the CIA really does hold very, very close, and they really were adamant not giving it to him.
The argument builds on different things which often are lumped together as security clearance. First of all, there is classification level, and that is confidential at the lowest, secret, then top secret. And that essentially defines the material as being dangerous if revealed, as being very dangerous or exceptionally dangerous. There's some
is there anything above top secret?
In terms of classification itself, no. But there are many people with top secret clearances who do not get to see a whole lot of intelligence information, because within the top secret clearances, there are compartments of information. And that is what is called the SCI, the specialized compartmented information. That apparently, according to the reporting, is what Jared was not getting from one of the agencies. Now, in that case, he had eligibility for top secret material, but if you're not seeing SCI, you're not seeing a whole lot of it. This played into the whole issue of whether Jared was getting the president's daily brief or not. Traditionally, the president's daily brief is a top secret SCI, every compartment possible document. There's no way that somebody who only has a top secret clearance but has no access to SCI material would be getting the president's daily brief unless it were highly redacted for his particular copy of it. And that would be very rare historically, possibly unprecedented. So the issue of what did Jared have? When did he have it? What was he allowed to see? Frankly, it's all a distracting conversation because if the president of the United States says, I don't care what his formal clearance is, I don't care if he has this SCI or whatever you people call it, he's getting my damn PDB. He's getting it. That's the president's decision to make.
Let's clarify this. So if the president is reading this and he calls up Sean Hannity, and he reads it to him verbatim.
Yep.
He has not violated the law. He's not violated the Constitution. He's done a really stupid, reckless thing to do, but it is within his power to do that.
100%.
I mean, if he wants to send this over to Alex Jones. He can send it to Alex Jones.
You can go one step further. You can say that he can decide as president that his president's daily brief will go to the vice president, the national security advisor, mm-hmm. his senior advisor, all the people who might normally get it. And one copy is hand-delivered to Vladimir Putin in Moscow. He can do that. That is within his power as the ultimate classification and declassification authority to do that. I suspect that there would be a whole number of officials as subordinates who would be making the president's daily brief rather anodyne and not be putting in some of the really good intelligence. But ultimately, that's our system. We have created a very strong presidency and derived from Article 2 of the Constitution as commander-in-chief things like security clearances and how to classify or declassify material. Ultimately, that is the person of the president. He has delegated a lot of it in traditional times to many other officials, but it really is a presidential decision.
Okay, so in what sense was this irresponsible and or abusive or whatever word?
It seems to be, but this is where the congressional oversight comes in.
To ask what question?
There's information we don't have about what were the concerns about Jared Kushner's clearance. Was it something, and let's go to the more innocent explanations of, well, normally if somebody forgot to put that many things on a form that many times and had so much financial interaction with foreigners, so many properties, so many phone calls that we can't explain, in a normal case, that might adversely affect a security clearance decision. That's on the more innocent side.
And we pretty much knew all those things.
Right. On the more serious side, it could be that in the investigation of chasing down some of these things, they found more worrisome elements, some things that were not just potential risks, not just opportunities for foreign manipulation of a person, but actual cases of it happening. Well, in that case, it's a little more severe. Either way, of course, the president can override it. But for oversight to find out what are those exact issues and exactly...
Now, will they be able to find that out? Do they have the ability to crack open? Because obviously this is a highly sensitive, highly classified bit of
information. It gets difficult because of classification. Yeah. But frankly, we've established oversight committees in Congress, the House Permanent Select Committee for Intelligence and the equivalent on the Senate side, which do classified closed hearings and investigations all the time. So one of the arguments that Mark and I made in that Washington Post op-ed is to the extent it's hitting up against either classification issues or, frankly, Privacy Act issues having to do with people's private information. Mm-hmm. If it could happen to Jared Kushner, it could happen to any of us. If information is provided in confidence as part of a U.S. government investigation, all of us expect that is not going to be broadcast out to the public. Well, guess what? You can do that in a closed hearing. Perhaps I can't remember the name of the committee. Maybe it's Government Affairs that Representative Cummings is running. Maybe that's not the place for this. Maybe some of this should actually be in Representative Schiff's committee, where they are more used to handling sensitive and even classified matters.
In terms of the way the president goes about doing his business, the collapse of the talks in North Korea. Do you want to talk about North Korea a little bit?
Absolutely.
I actually think it was a relief that the president did not make a deal, a really, really bad deal. And I think he does deserve some credit for at least being willing to walk away. On the other hand, you have the shambolic nature of this summit, which is summits are usually prepared in great detail.
Yep.
By the time the principals show up, the deal should either be cooked or not, right? I mean, it's pretty much, 80-90%? What would you say? It should be pretty much done.
In most cases, it is not only planned to be that way, but it has played out that way. There are definitely the exceptions. For example, Reagan at Reykjavik, walking out there and deciding, maybe we'll just get rid of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Things like that can happen. But I think you're right. Good planning doesn't mean a summit or a meeting is going to go well. But bad planning almost ensures that it does.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the story.
And that's what we had here. Now, was it catastrophic? Thankfully, no. We could have had a president who not only doubled down by going to the first meeting and then quadrupled down by going to the second meeting, but what would it be, octupled down by giving into something that he shouldn't have just to save face? Thankfully, he stopped that process before it got truly exponential. But it was not a good look for the United States. Frankly, it was not a good look for the president. If you're praising the president because he walked away from a summit that he himself insisted upon before it created catastrophe, that's a pretty low bar to clear.
And there are some other issues. I mean, obviously, he did give some things away, so he didn't completely walk away. The comments on Otto Warmbier, am I pronouncing it right?
Warmbier.
I mean, are breathtaking. Even after what happened in Helsinki, it was breathtaking to hear the President of the United States basically give the regime a pass on the clear abuse, torture, perhaps murder of an American citizen.
Once in a while, you will see, and it's happened several times in the last, 3 years since Trump entered the national stage in this way, where even the Trump surrogates, they call them, on cable TV, will just shake their head and say, sorry, I got nothing. They can't do that. I think it was Santorum who finally gave up and said, yep, I can't do anything on that one. He shouldn't have said it.
And then he got ripped for it by the usual suspects. And also the cancellation of the war games, where his president said what I call war games.
Well, and that's the issue here is, yes, he walked away from the summit before he agreed to a deal that objectively should not have been agreed to. But what did he do? He gave Kim additional credibility in the international sphere by getting the President of the United States to essentially fly to him. Now, not to North Korea, but flying close to him and shaking hands and smiling and all of this, calling him a good guy, calling him a good friend, ignoring the oppression in North Korea, which is truly abysmal. So he makes Kim look better, opens up international, if not recognition, but more international interactions with Kim, which is objectively not a good thing. But then also, what about the human rights issue? What about that? After this case with this man and what happened to him, this is not a good result. We can be encouraged that it was not a worse result, but we shouldn't pretend that this is a sunny day.
No, we can't. And this is and also the whole comment that, you know, a lot of people who are born into families that are successful don't turn out well, but you turned out well. This is a guy that had his uncle executed with any aircraft guns. I want to go back to this whole question of what the president has the power to do versus what's the right thing to do. The other big story we've had last week is the report that he had very specifically put pressure on his former economic advisor, Gary Cohn, to pressure the Department of Justice to go after AT&T to stop that merger, with the implication that it was because he was retaliating against CNN. He hates CNN. CNN is full of fake news. AT&T had won in court. The Justice Department had appeared to be taking positions that would have been favorable to that merger. President multiple times put pressure on his Department of Justice to go back into court, which, of course, they did, ultimately failed. But again, going back to your point before, he does have the ability to do that, but there are inappropriate uses of that power.
There are a whole bunch of things a president can do. A president can fire an FBI director. Apparently, a president can go on Twitter and say what he wants. A president can revoke security clearances or grant them. But again, doesn't mean they should. That sure looked to me like abuse of power, the attempt to do that and then insisting that it be done. The other part that caught my eye, Charlie, was the fact that in the reporting on that story, it said that the president said he went back something like 50 times when no action was being taken. He couldn't believe that his subordinate was not taking action. And that took me back to something that I wasn't even sure I would include in my book on how to get rid of a president, which is removal in place, when there's a president who is still the president, but is being emasculated by his own subordinates such that he does not fully have the power of the presidency. This sure smells like that, because you have the president saying do it and somebody ignoring it, and saying do it and somebody ignoring it 50 times. Now, rightfully, the president sets policy and people execute his lawful orders. In this case, you have somebody, in a sense, removing some of the power of the presidency, even if only temporarily. It builds into some other cases we've seen, such as the report in the book Fear last year, which talked about this, the slow rolling of the president, the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, writing about how people were not enacting some of the president's more misguided impulses. It fed into that whole narrative.
Okay, speaking of that, we just came on the anniversary of that. I don't remember what it was, the anniversary of the publication of that anonymous op-ed piece. I'm guessing that if you and I spoke the day after, we would probably agree that, well, sure, we're going to find out who did it, right?
Right.
I'm amazed that they never found out who wrote that piece.
I assume, but it is an assumption, because we haven't seen a lot of reporting on the investigation. I assume that it has been investigated, that they decided to find out who did this. On the other hand, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and read every word. I'm not sure there's anything in that letter that was classified.
No.
I think maybe it's unseemly. Maybe it's uncomfortable for the president. But there's nothing there that's beyond a normal leak about who's having dinner with whom, which is not sensitive information.
You can't do a criminal investigation.
No, the president could fire somebody for being disloyal, which seems to be one of his pet issues. But I'm not sure that the investigation had a whole lot of steam within the bureaucracy to follow through on it. And let's be honest, a week later, we were all talking about something else.
Yeah,
our own attention, as we
do about everything. So on this Department of Justice, I guess I'm almost stuck on this because it is the slow, you know, recognition of the power of the president. So the president has the power of calling in his attorney general. You tell me if I'm wrong on this.
Right.
And says, I really hate Jeff Bezos. Mm-hmm. I want you to open a criminal investigation into him because I'm just tired of what his newspaper is saying and doing. So I am ordering you to launch a criminal investigation into this critic. Does he have the power to do that?
Ultimately, probably he does.
Yes.
But you're hitting one of the two institutions in the executive branch that are a little bit different. One of them is the Department of Justice, and within it, things like the FBI. And the other is the intelligence community, which is all other parts of the executive branch are policy. But these also start to get into other issues when you come to justice and intelligence. That's why there are so many rules. Mm-hmm. That's why there's so much oversight into how it is done. Traditionally, in recent history, no, the president should not do that. And there's all of these rules saying, well, the president just doesn't. You remember the whole issue about whether the attorney general was on a plane near the candidate's husband.
Yes.
And those are the norms and institutions that developed around the Department of Justice, especially post-Watergate, but even before then, to say there's something different about investigations.
Well, I mean, and this is the distinction, if I'm reading you right, that he may have the legal power to do something, and yet it would also be, if he exercised the power in the way that I just described, it would be an impeachable offense.
Correct.
Because it would be such an abuse to use the power of the presidency and the Department of Justice to go after and harass a political opponent. You may have the technical power to do that, but that doesn't mean that what you are doing is all right.
Both can be true. The example I used in the Washington Post piece with Mark Zaid was if the president decided, using his inherent constitutional authority as commander-in-chief, that there was an imminent threat from Iceland due to the existence of the singer Bjork, he could launch our entire nuclear arsenal at Iceland. We have given the president that power, and it would not be right, not only for Bjork, not only for Iceland, not only for humanity, but just that's not what is meant by the power of the commander-in-chief to be that arbitrary. And yet, he could do it. Totally different issue from whether he should, and that would clearly be an impeachable offense. Similar thing comes up on all of these issues, which is at what level does it rise to something that could be defined by the House of Representatives as a high crime or misdemeanor.
Okay, perfect segue. Let's talk about this. The House committee going deep dive into Trump world, deep dive into his business associates, his family members.
I don't think it's a deep dive yet.
Okay.
Yes, people were impressed
81?
By a long list of 81 people. There's a whole lot of people who are not on that list who have relevant information.
Hmm.
And I think it may have been Nadler who said it. He said, this is the initial list.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a deep dive. I shouldn't say it isn't, but it is not nearly as deep as the entire
pool.
There's a deeper dive. There's a deeper end to this pool. This is the beginning. And if they did it the way that I believe I read they did it smartly, which is to say, you know what? We're not going to have to request 1,000 different documents from each one of you. We're just going to say, give us what you gave the special counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to establish the same fact base in case
like a mirror image.
Yeah, in case they don't get anything in a ultimate Mueller report, such that it may be. In case they don't get anything that gives them all of the facts, they're going to have all the facts. It's still going to take processing time. It's still going to take additional investigatory work on their part because they're not going to get everything that the special counsel did at every minute of their investigation. But it's a good start.
Well, you of course, have seen what the White House is saying about this. This is abusive. This is outrageous. The president over the weekend is using, saying that these investigations are bullshit. This is the president of the United
States. Presidential harassment, all caps.
Presidential harassment, all of that. So,
What I call it? What? I call it oversight.
And the surprise, of course, is that this comes after 2 years of no oversight.
Right.
And the contrast is pretty dramatic.
And that's why it's such a dramatic difference, especially for the White House to see this, because what the House Intelligence Committee was doing, for example, was not really oversight of the president's activities. It was quite the opposite. So to see it now in such stark contrast probably does look like presidential harassment to him. But for somebody who has not studied the Constitution, who has not studied the history of checks and balances, it is known by the other word, which is oversight of executive branch activities. We have to remember, the legislative branch is Article 1. Mm-hmm. It comes first. It sets the laws. It tells the executive what to do to execute those laws and then oversees the execution of said laws. That's not the way the president sees it.
No, it's not the way he sees it. And I do remember when he was a candidate and meeting with some of the congressional leadership for the first time, they had to actually explain to him what the Article 1 powers were. And they came out of those meetings shaking their head. I'm not sure we've ever had a president who understood that less. Of course, it's easier for the president and his supporters to deflect the congressional investigations as partisan, because it is partisan. But having said that, the nonpartisan nature of the special counsel's investigation has not stopped him from attempting to discredit that as well.
Right.
So, I mean, he's gonna say the same thing.
In a sense, he's hurt his own argument in that way. If he would have said, and this assumes a whole lot of things that we know inherently aren't true, but if he would have said from the beginning, I do not want a Democratic investigation of me because it will inherently be partisan, even though he's not really a Republican, fine, put that aside. But I will accept anything a special counsel does because it is independent, we would be having a different conversation right now, mm-hmm. because it would actually make those Democratic-led House committee investigations look more partisan. But frankly, he's been attacking everyone and everything that isn't echoing his line.
Okay, so let's go back to the Article 1. Mm-hmm. Senator Mike Lee is the head of what? The Article 1 committee project, something. He's Mr. Article 1, okay. Right? You know, in the Senate. Hmm. I'm trying to, without making a prediction, what would it say about the status of constitutional conservatism if Mr. Article 1 votes with the president on the emergency declaration? Because his vote's still in play, obviously.
I would like to see the logic. We can't require it. Mm-hmm. That's up to his constituents to demand it. But I would like to see the logic of how can you believe A, B, and C and then do something which appears to be in contradiction. There may be a logic there, but I don't know what it is that is consistent with those principles.
Yeah, I mean, even if we seem to keep coming back to this, even if Mike Lee believes that the president is within his legal bounds, the Senate obviously has the ability to make a statement about the propriety of violating the Article 1, the spirit of the article of Article 1, the checks and balances, and the prerogatives of Congress. That would be something that a Senate. Oh yeah, it's called the Article 1 Project. States Senator Mike Lee, or the Article 1 Project. So I'm just reading this off the website. Is a new network of House and Senate legislators working together on a new agenda of government reform and congressional rehabilitation. Hmm. So I don't know. It would seem like if you want to do congressional rehabilitation,
this is a good example,
wouldn't
right?
it be? Yeah, wouldn't
it's
a
good opportunity
be?
To make that.
That's just me.
What I would like to see, and of course it doesn't work this way, but I really would love to see them accidentally substitute in when this comes to a vote, instead of Donald Trump, President Trump, put in President Barack Obama, and instead of this, put in something else. And you would see whether it's a principled vote or a partisan vote.
Well, it is interesting that the president's line, of course, is that they say that the Democrats will use this as a precedent to invoke their own emergencies. They're going to do it anyway. And that appears to be kind of the fig leaf that I think a number of Republicans have been seizing on, that, yeah, the Democrats are going to come in. This is why we can never elect them, because they'll do it on all of this stuff, whether or not we do it.
You know what I would love to see, Charlie? Yeah. I would love to see all of the, 870 Democratic candidates for president now, and Bill Weld and any other Republican candidates, and even the potential independent runs like Howard Schultz. I would love to see all of them sign a pledge saying, no, we are not going to use what this president does as precedent for our presidential actions. In fact, we will agree to do this, this, and this. And one of those things probably would be, we will not use the excuse of an emergency declaration for something we disagree with to allow us to use it for something we agree with.
Well, in fact, I think the exact opposite is happening. I was at a meeting this morning where somebody was talking about how this is coming up on the campaign trail for the Democrats, and Democratic candidates are being asked, well, what would you declare a national emergency for?
And the right answer should be nothing short of an invasion, a physical invasion of our country. And I don't mean the caravans thousands of miles away.
But the Elizabeth Warrens of the world are answering. They're going through, you know, climate change. They're going through, you know, guns, etc. And right. I don't think it requires that much.
Well, you know what you do is when you have a case like that, and let's use climate change as an example. What do? You build a coalition. You get the votes in Congress to enable what you want to do. You don't do an end run around Congress when it's already said what the will of the people is. It doesn't work that way.
Well, perhaps we could save a lot of money, because if you have both political parties adopt this, the concept of the use of emergency orders, why the hell do we need a Congress? Congress is expensive. Okay, one last thing, breaking news as we're talking. President is saying that he's totally flip-flopping on withdrawing all the troops from Syria, which really raises the question, so did we actually just lose Jim Mattis for nothing, the Secretary of Defense?
Yeah, I would love to sit down and have a heart-to-heart with Jim Mattis and say, what was the final straw? Was it the thought of abandoning our Kurdish allies in Syria? Or was it, at the same time that story came out, there were stories coming out about, and is the president going to do the same thing in Afghanistan to our allies there?
I think you're right.
Was it a 1-2 punch that got Jim Mattis to say, and his statement would back this up about the importance of allies and relationships, was it Syria itself? I still don't know. Now, either way, it's a valid point, which is, okay, when you choose what hill you're going to die on, or what hill you're going to resign on in this case, you need to think through what are you doing it for and why, and what will the result be? If it's you can't look yourself in the mirror, if this one thing happens, and maybe it is selling out the Kurds, okay, that's fine. But you also have to have some consequentialist view of, okay, and what is this going to accomplish? Right. Some people weigh one more than the other. But in terms of what this accomplished, if in fact Mattis resigned because of Syria, I wonder, what's it all for?
Well, okay, but I do agree with you that I think it is likely that it was the 1-2 punch. At least that's the way it felt when it was playing out in real time.
Right.
It also could have been just the exhaustion of watching the way decisions were made, that if in fact you are being ignored on these substantive issues, and perhaps his resignation has created the environment that has made this decision possible. We don't know. David Priest, thank you so much for coming in once
again.
Welcome. I appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.